arrest me? What for? I am a law-abiding citizen whose sole focus is to improve this city, not some hooligan sitting down on the grass in Gezi Park smoking drugs and drinking beer.
Jekka remained calm. She'd been expecting this. Either he was a good actor, or he hadn't seen the news.
A woman we believe has a connection to you has been found dead in an apartment in Moda, she said. He stood, his mouth slightly open, silent.
The woman's name hasn't as yet been released to the media, Jekka said, but she was called Mrs. Aishel Ojal.
Known as Gulizar when she used to strip for a living, Suleiman said.
I believe so. Jekka smiled. 25 years old, originally from Sulukule.
How on earth would I know anyone like that? Uddin said. How?
She shrugged.
Don't know, sir.
But she had a lot of photographs of you on her computer, and you weren't just drinking coffee and making polite conversation, if you know what I mean.
No, I don't, actually.
In one you were naked and in a state of arousal, Suleiman said. Another, one of many, was what I believe is called a selfie of you and Mrs. Ojal, where you were both naked, and you have a hand on...
This is monstrous! He ran a hand through his hair. Why would someone like me know some foul, indecent gypsy?
I never said she was a gypsy, Suleiman said.
You said she came from Sulukule, he bellowed. They were all dirty gypsies there.
Gypsies, mainly.
Dirty. I don't know this woman. The photographs are fakes, composites. People can do such things on computers now, he said. Show them to me.
The computer is being examined by forensic investigators. They're part of a crime scene. I can't.
Well, they have to be composites anyway, he said. Have to be.
Why? Why would Mrs. Ojal make composite sex pictures of you, Tekker said. Unless, of course, you do know about this because she was trying to blackmail you. Gypsies can't like people like you, Mr. Erden, can they? Developers who destroy their homes. Suddenly deflated, he sat down on one of his many pink sofas and put his chin in his hands.
Quite honestly, if you were having an affair with this woman, I couldn't give a damn, Dekker said. Even if you bought that Modo apartment for her, it's none of my business.
The curvature of the Modo building still hadn't been found, and so far all that had come to light had been a large set of photographs of Erdin, with Aishel Ojal, or alone, often asleep on her bed. He'd been to that apartment. He'd certainly had sex with her. That no one in the building had recognized him meant either that he always went to Moda in disguise, or that no one in the block knew who he was.
The reason we're here, Dekker continued, is to find out where you were between the hours of 9 p.m. last night and 2 a.m. this morning. If you had an affair with her, I really don't care. I want to know if you killed her.
Yanis Negroponte couldn't sleep. A 25-year-old woman had been found dead in her apartment at Moda. Although the police had not released her name to the media, he wondered whether it could be Gulizar the gypsy. And, although he had never borne her any ill will, he hoped that it was her. The police suspected foul play, and so, whether her lover Ahmed Erdin had killed her or not was almost irrelevant. Somehow his connection to her would come up, and then his reputation as an upright, moral man would be ruined. Then he'd leave them alone. He read the news item in Cumhuriyet again. The woman had been found in a third-floor apartment in a block that overlooked the Sea of Marmara. That described Gulizar the gypsy's accommodation exactly. Yanis breathed raggedly. Did he dare to hope that it was her? Did he further dare to dream that Erdin had killed her? But if he had, he couldn't think why, unless it had been an accident. Although she was very obviously sexy, Gulizar was discreet, and she was his only mistress, which implied that he had to be attached to her. But had she been attached to him? He was good-looking and rich, but other than that, if one needed any more than that, he was an odious bigot. As a gypsy, Gulizar must have been affected by developers like Erdin, if not Erdin himself. They bought sites in gypsy areas with impunity, or so it seemed to Yanis. had she finally argued with him about it, and he'd killed her in a fight? He heard Anastasia cough upstairs, and breathed shallowly so that he could hear her. If she suddenly gagged, he might have to go up and make sure that she was all right. But she didn't, and he went back to his newspaper again. In the morning, when Harker came in, he'd ask him if he'd heard any more about the killing in Moda. He knew Chetin Ekmen well, and so the inspector might have told him something.
The last time I went in to see Kelimir last night was 8 o'clock, Mary said. Mr. Semi Erdin had left to go back to his own apartment, and because Kelimir was ill, it was decided that we would all have an early night.
Although Mary spoke reasonable Turkish, Tekir had decided to conduct her interview in English. It was the middle of the night, and the woman was clearly scared. It made sense, and would hopefully reduce misunderstanding.
When I went in this morning at 7, Mr. Erdin was lying on top of the bed I'd made up for him in Kelimir's room, Mary said.
Was he in his night clothes or dressed? Tekir asked. I ask because you said that he was on top of the bed and not inside.
He was in his night clothes, but it was hot.
Do you know whether Mr. Erdin left his daughter's room at all during the night? Suleiman had asked the question. Mary turned her attention to him.
No, she said. I certainly didn't hear anyone moving around in the night, and I sleep in the room next door to Kelimir. Not that I did sleep.
And yet I noticed a bottle of sleeping pills on your nightstand, Miss Cox. She turned back to Tekir. If you were having trouble sleeping, why didn't you take one? The commissioner asked.
I don't take them often.
Mary looked down.
Usually I have to stay alert in case Kelimir needs me in the night. But whenever I have a night off, or like last night when Mr. Erdin was with her, I do take pills to help me sleep. Generally.
Why didn't you on this occasion?
I wanted to be alert in case Mr. Erdin needed me. Kelimir was very sick.
Does your employer know about your pill habit?
I don't know.
You've not told him?
No.
She coloured a little.
Mr. Erdin is a very moral man. He doesn't drink, smoke, or take drugs. Maybe I should have told him, but I just didn't know how. Will you tell him?
Dekker said, no. If you didn't take them last night, then they're irrelevant to this investigation. But if the situation becomes more serious, then maybe that subject will have to be addressed. I suggest you tell him yourself now, Miss Cox. Mary nodded, but she looked extremely anxious. While Ömer Mungun sat with Erdin in his lounge, Tekir and Suleiman were with Mary in the kitchen. Small, pale, and older than she looked, Mary Cox was a career nanny who had been all over the world with her children. She never married, and probably never would. Tekir and Suleiman had, so far, told Mary nothing about why they needed to know where Erdin had been the previous night. But now Tekir said, Miss Cox, do you know whether your employer is in a relationship at the moment? Mary looked flustered. You may answer without fear and truthfully, Tekir said. Your employer cannot discipline you for that. They don't do that. Tekir knew that was a lie, but she said it anyway. Hundreds of domestic workers were dismissed every year because they gossiped about their employers' sex lives. But Mary Cox's continued employment wasn't her problem. Mary, however, shook her head.
Mr. Erdin is a very moral man, she said. I have never seen him with any woman, apart from the servants and his secretary.
And what of them? Suleiman asked. Has he...
Oh, he would never abuse his staff. Mary was horrified. No, 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 no.
And yet it was well known that on his building sites he was a harsh boss who dismissed men he felt didn't work hard enough, and, it was said, was not above physically abusing them. It was possible he didn't bring that into his home, and also possible that he didn't prey on his female domestic staff.
Mr. Erdin has always said that he will never marry anyone while Kelimir is still at home,
Mary said. Decker frowned. Will Calimé ever leave home? She said.
With support, she could have her own flat, apartment, one day, Mary said. I know what a lot of people think about Down syndrome individuals, but a lot of them can cope. I knew a married couple with Downs back in England.
Did you? When Decker and Silliman walked back into the salon, Urdin said, Well?
Miss Cox says that you slept in your daughter's room last night, Mr. Urdin, Decker said. He stuck his chin in the air.
I told you so. Why didn't you believe me? Emma Mungun drove Decker and Silliman back to police headquarters. The two uniformed officers followed on behind. As they drove through the pretty Bosphorus village of Ortaköy, Decker said to Silliman,
Well, even with my gloves on, I don't suppose Mr. Urdin is happy with the treatment I meted out to him. I imagine his lawyer will be on the phone to me in a few hours' time.
Madam, do you think that it's possible those photographs of him with Mrs. Ojo are accomplices? Silliman said.
No, of course not.
Whether he killed her or not is open to question, and we'll have to wait for forensics to guide us on that, Decker said. But he was having sex with her, no question. He was worried, and he was guilty.
When you both left the room, he didn't say a word to me, Irma said.
No?
Nothing. I got the feeling he was embarrassed, Irma said.
If he's been caught out in an affair, particularly with an ex-stripper, he probably is embarrassed, Decker said.
What I want to know is whether he murdered her or not. His political allies can all wring their hands in false shock at his liaison with a filthy whore, but we have to catch her killer, and if that is him?
A group of what looked like young boys in Guy Fawkes masks ran into the road in front of the car, carrying an anarchy banner. Irma slammed on the brakes. The boys stopped, laughed, and then ran away. Nobody in the car said anything.
Semi Urdin looked across at his brother with disgust.
How could you? He said.
With a whore? How many people do we know who would have matched you with a clean, pious girl you could have married and had more children with?
How could I? Ahmed Urdin said. With Kelly May. How could I bring her a stepmother who might hate her?
If the woman hated Kelly May, you could divorce her. Or what if we had children, this woman and I, normal children? Would I love them more than Kelly May because they are normal? Would I love them more because their mother was not a selfish slut like her mother? Would Kelly May just fade into the background of my life and die without my noticing? That is not the right way of things. That is not the Islamic thing to do.
And buying an apartment for a cheap gypsy and having sex with her is.
Simi shook his head. You delude yourself because you want this woman. Who is dead?
Ahmed stood up and paced the salon.
How can she be? I saw her 3 days ago. Nothing had changed. She didn't complain about being followed or leered at.
She probably liked it.
No, she didn't!
Ahmed bent down to shout into his brother's face.
Gulizar gave herself to me, alone. I did everything for her. Bought her an apartment, her clothes, surgery. I loved her. And before you say anything, my brother, I have built this business. I have given you a job, an apartment, and a life of ease. Put this about, tell your friends about this, and all that will go.
Simi shook his head.
I won't tell anyone, Ahmed, and you know it, he said. I just need to understand why, because you are my brother.
Why what?
Why you went with her. I know you didn't kill her, Semi said.
Good. I just wish the police did.
Ahmed sat down again. I'd never find anyone as loyal and discreet as Gulizar.
Why would I kill her?
I know you're a man of the world, Semi. She would do anything sexual. No headaches, no not feeling well. Every time I went to the apartment, I left satisfied. And she was beautiful. But as long as she gave me love like that, I would love her, old and wrinkled as she may have become in the end.
Ugh! Don't sneer. You don't know what she was like.
Then why aren't you crying? Simi asked, if you loved her so much.
Ahmed knitted his fingers underneath his chin.
I don't know. Maybe I'm in shock?
He thought for a while, then said,
I was always discreet when I went there. I wore a hat and a coat, and I kept my head down. Occasionally I spoke to the cabbager, but only to pass the time of day.
Did you know she was taking photographs of you?
I knew she had some. She really wanted them. We were apart so often.
And yet you deny that you're in them,
Simi said. I can't own up to an affair with someone like Gulizar. It would ruin my reputation.
Simi leaned in towards his brother. But if you don't, and they prove those photographs are genuine, they will think that you killed her.
They think I killed her anyway. That woman, Commissioner Tekir, is from the East. She's a devil-worshipping Yazidi.
His teeth ground and his face contorted.
She'll do anything to stop people like us.
Did you see her at Gezi giving those hooligans hell?
No, she likes them. She's a commissioner of police, and she isn't doing her duty.
Simi said nothing. His brother often had strange ideas about people who opposed them. He thought the Greek archaeologist who'd tried to get him to rehouse the rubbish pickers of Gizli Tepe was a spy. Now she was dead. Ahmed shook his head.
So much going on, but I can't let any of this distract me, he said. The Negroponte house still has its secret intact, and we must take it and destroy it. When the sun comes up, you must go to Kadikoy and begin moving some of the larger bulldozers across the Bosphorus. Why leave them there to be destroyed by vandals anyway?
But you still haven't bought the Negroponte house. Ahmed waved a hand dismissively.
I don't care, he said. Tomorrow I will get into that house and make that man sign it over to me, even if I have to break his gates and his front door down.
Chapter 17
Mehmed Bey?
Suleiman looked up.
I apologize if I'm disturbing your work, Igmen said. You're not.
Emir Mungun had gone to Dr. Sarkisian's laboratory to get the Armenian's preliminary findings on the body of Aishal Ojal. He pointed to Emir's chair.
Please have a seat, Çetin Bey.
Igmen entered what had once been an office almost as familiar to him as his own. They had spoken since the previous autumn, after Aisha Farsakolu's death, but only when it had been strictly necessary, and usually by telephone. This visit was unusual. Mehmet Suleiman tried not to feel joy or hope, but he smiled.
How can I help you? He asked.
Igmen took a deep breath.
I know that you're working on the Moda death, he said.
Aishal Ojal, yes. Igmen took another deep breath. Either he was nervous, or didn't really want to be there, or both.
I've heard last night you interviewed the property developer, Ahmed Öden, he said.
Suleiman sat back in his chair.
What if I did? I have an interest in him, Igmen said, in relation to the hippodrome body. He had a dispute with my victim.
What about?
Mehmet, did you interview Öden last night or not?
Was he being evasive with Igmen, just for the sport, or had he been told to keep Öden close to his chest? Tekir hadn't wanted Öden brought in, yet, but if she knew that Igmen had an interest too, surely they could discuss the property developer, however sensitive his position was.
Suleiman got up, closed and locked his door, opened his window and offered Igmen a cigarette. He saw Igmen almost refuse and then capitulate.
Suleiman sat down and they both lit up.
We think that Aysel Erdin, otherwise known as Gulizar, was Erdin's mistress, Suleiman said. She owned that apartment outright, paid for with cash, and I've not met many 20-something strippers who can do that.
He saw Igmen smile.
Can't prove, yet, that Erdin bought it for her, but photographs of him with her, without her, and in various compromising positions, were all over her computer and her phone, Suleiman went on.
So much for the saintly among us.
He claims that the photographs are composites, created on computer, but he's clutching at thin air, Suleiman said. However, they don't prove that he killed her. Emma has just gone to the lab to get Dr. Sarkisian's preliminary report on the body. Burned in the bath? Yes, wrist slit. But Dr. Sarkisian thinks that she was almost dead when that was done. He's looking for blows, toxins. What about your own involvement with Odin? Igman drew on his cigarette. Twofold. One to do with this dispute he had with Dr. Ariadne Sava, who set herself up as protector of the rubbish pickers he evicted in Gizli Tepe, and another one centered round the old Negroponte house. Is that what some people call the Greek house on Kabasako, Jadisi? Yes, owned by Madame Anastasia Negroponte, proper old Byzantine, and her son Yanis.
Suleiman frowned. Wasn't he the one who came back from Germany after 40 years or something?
That's him, Igman said. Always been questions about Yanis. But his mother, if she's his mother, loves him, and that's all that matters. Odin wants the Negroponte house, and he's been sending his men to rev up bulldozers outside the front door and playing mind games with Yanis.
Has he offered the Negropontes money?
Yes, lots. It sounds like a lot to me, and I expect it would to you as well. But the point is that neither Madame Anastasia nor her son Yanis want to sell.
Well then, Odin can't... Oh, now, come on, Mehmet Bey. You know that these developers can do as they please now, Igman said. With the help of compliant advocates, they twist and torture the law into shapes where it's possible for them to get what they want. And if that fails, they use force. And with the word progress on their side, well...
Odin isn't going to tear the Negroponte house down, is he?
Suleiman said.
He wants to.
Why?
It's an historic... He wants to build the best and most luxurious hotel on the Sultan Ahmed Peninsula, Igman said. Make the Four Seasons look like a Gece Kondo.
Suleiman shook his head. If he was honest, he did like some of the new build apartments that were springing up across the city, provided they weren't in faux Ottoman style. But he didn't like them when they were built at the expense of lovely old structures, or made already poor people homeless. In his experience, that just led to vagrancy, drug abuse, and alcoholism.
"How did you get involved with the Negroponte house?" he asked. "Their old servant, Harker Bey, called me in. He knows me because I used to go there as a child. My mother would read Madame Anastasia's cards. Then mother died, and then we had 1955, Igman said. And I know something else you've been working on, which may relate to that year.
You've been speaking to Omer.
Igman shrugged.
A body found in the Galatasaray Lycee Gardens, Suleiman said. He may date from the awful events of 1955, or he may not.
What we do know is that all the fatalities connected with the anti-Greek riots were accounted for long ago. The unusual thing about this unknown man is that his teeth have been extensively capped and filled using high-class materials and with a lot of skill. He wasn't poor.
So he was more likely to be Greek.
But all the Greeks have been accounted for, Suleiman said.
A foreign visitor?
Omer has made contact with a dentist whose father was practicing in Biulu at the time. He did complicated remedial work for those who could pay. But it was a long time ago, and the dentist's father is dead. She told Omer she'd try to find what remains of his records from that year, if she can.
Madame Anastasia was badly beaten during the anti-Greek riots, Igman said. Never been the same since. Her husband Nikos was killed. Torn to pieces by the mob.
Suleiman shook his head. I must have seen his name on a list of the dead.
I don't know whether we'll ever know who the Galatasaray man was. It may not be possible now. The forensic archaeologist, Dr. Agildas,
ah, yes, she worked with my hippodrome victim on a rather older skeleton, Igman said.
Oh?
He told Suleiman about Ariadne Sava's find.
But if no Paleologi descendants exist, then how was she ever going to prove that particular skeleton was that of the last emperor? Suleiman asked.
I don't know, and nor, more significantly, does Dr. Agildas.
Sava didn't tell her.
Frustrating.
Like so many things in life, Igman said.
Suleiman wondered if he was referring to him and his behavior towards women, but he said nothing.
The main reason I came here this morning was to alert you about my interest in Ahmed Erdin, Igmen said, and to tell you that if you want to speak to him and he isn't at home, he will in all likelihood be sitting in his car outside the Negroponte house. As you know, there are no parking restrictions on the street, and so theoretically he can sit there as long as he likes. I know he's messing with Yanis's head, and it's working. Yanis is becoming hysterical, and much as I know he is committed to keeping that house, I fear he may sell just to get Erdin out of his life. I wish I could do more to help him, but I must tread carefully. We all have to tread carefully with big businessmen, Suleiman said. Did you know that when I went out to Erdin's place last night, Commissioner Tekke came too? In fact, she led. Igmen shook his head. Apparently I'm not exalted enough to interview a builder on my own. Suleiman smiled. Makes me want to weep, Igmen said. And on top of that, I have to be extra careful, because I'm also investigating the death of Ariadne Saba, with whom Erdin had some issues. I've no proof he killed her, and given the fact that her newborn baby was taken from her before she died, I can't imagine that it was Erdin. Why would he want someone else's baby? Unless it was his. I doubt that, Igmen said. Dr. Sava was Greek, and Mr. Erdin, I am reliably informed by the Negroponte's servant Hakka, comes from one of those families who attacked the Greeks in 55. Back to that again. He's also very vocal about his support for turning Hagia Sophia into a mosque. He's everything the people in Gezi Park hate, and I imagine he's feeling threatened by what's happening there. You think so? Yes. Not that I've given it much thought. My Kamal spends most of his time in Gezi these days, while his mother rails against everything it stands for. I'll be honest. I care. I understand. But I'm more concerned that any moment now I am going to discover a dead baby, because it has to be dead now. And then I'm going to have to tell Mr. Sava that on top of the death of his daughter, he's going to have to absorb the death of his grandchild, too. They sat in silence, looking at each other. In spite of the grim subject matter, Suleiman had missed conversations like this. He'd missed Igmen. Oh, and another thing, Igmen said. Yes? One of the rubbish pickers Ariadne Sava was trying to help claims she knew that Ahmed Erdin had a mistress. He didn't know who she was or where she lived, but he did describe her as a prostitute. Some would describe Aishel Ojal so. Igmen shrugged. Don't know if it's true, or if it will be of any use to you. Intelligence is always useful, Suleiman said, particularly from you. Right. Igmen was embarrassed. I have to go. He stood up. Do you? Suleiman imagined the needy look on his own face, and felt as if he should be ashamed, but he wasn't. Chetin, I have missed you, he said. Igmen looked down at him and shook his head. I can't take it any more, Mehmet, he said. I saw Gonca. Did she tell you? No. She begged me to make peace with you, because you were so unhappy. She said you'd never come to me. I, Mehmet, no, Igmen said. I am just not ready to do that. I know you. I know what's happening. You're unhappy, and you're making Gonca unhappy, and so your eyes are wandering in the direction of other women. I've known you for over 20 years. But when you did it to Sergeant Fasakolu, you crossed a line, and it's going to take me a long time to forgive you. He walked towards the office door. Suleiman put his head in his hands. Just don't compound what you've already done by breaking Gonca's heart, Igmen said. She loves you, and she's a good woman. Throw her away, and you'll be setting yourself up for a very lonely and miserable old age. You may be a handsome prince, but nobody will care when you're 65, unless you have money. Now, let's keep each other informed regarding Ahmed Erdin. Yes, Chetin Bey. Igmen left. Mehmet Suleiman, alone at his desk,
felt as if he had just been told off by his old class teacher back at the Lycée.
Mr. Urdin?
He was just about to leave and get over to the Negroponte house. What did Mary want now? They'd already spoken about what had happened with the police.
Can I have a word with you, please? She said.
What about?
About the police. About something that happened the night before last. Something I haven't told you.
He took her into his office. What? He said. He hadn't even offered her a seat.
When the police came last night, I lied to them about something, Mary said.
He was unable to fathom this woman. Maybe it was because she was a foreigner, or maybe it was just her. He didn't know and hadn't cared, because he'd always intended to replace her with a cheaper Turkish version as soon as he could. Mary, without being asked, sat down. Unnerved by her boldness, Ahmed said, I have a lot to do. I can't...
You went out the night that woman in Moda died, Mary said. I heard you leave Kelime's room, and then I looked out of my window and saw you get into the MX-5. She slept the whole time, but I didn't take a sleeping pill. I stayed awake in case she needed help. You came back at just gone 3.
Ahmed Erdin pulled his chair out from behind his desk and sat down.
How could you leave her like that, Mr. Erdin, after you'd promised her you'd stay with her?
He didn't answer because there was no answer.
Did you think that I'd just take a sleeping pill when I knew that Kelime was ill?
You generally do, he said. Take pills, I mean.
Not when I know I can't.
He lowered his gaze from her eyes. So what did you tell the police, Mary?
What I told you I told them, Mr. Erdin, she said, that I was awake all night and heard no one leave the house. I told them you didn't know that sometimes I took sleeping tablets, but that I would tell you in due course.
But I know you take tablets.
Yes, and I imagine you thought I'd taken one the night before last, didn't you?
Until I learned you had been awake, yes.
Now, I know that you didn't kill that woman because you were a good man, Mr. Erdin, which was why I withheld that information from the police.
Your confidence in me is very pleasing, he said.
But I knew the police wouldn't see it that way, she said, which was why I lied. That said, I do feel, Mr. Erdin, sir, that in order to feel right with myself, I do need to know where you did go.
She looked at him very steadily, which was unnerving. Apart from knowing where he went, what else did she want? She had to want something for herself, otherwise why lie to the police? I went to look at a new site I'm considering developing in the Belgrade Forest, he said.
Oh. She didn't believe him.
He embellished. You have to look at prospective investments at night as well as in the day. I wanted to see what could be seen of the cityscape from that vantage point, and also whether the area is used by vagrants or drug addicts. I have to think of the security of my men when I purchase a new site.
Of course.
The Belgrade Forest wasn't far from Bebek. He knew she knew this. He also knew she'd be wondering what he'd been doing there for 4+ hours. He had no words. But then Mary spoke.
Mr. Erdin, all I've ever wanted from this job has been security. I love Kelime, and I do hope that you will be able to continue to employ me as her companion for many years to come. I require neither big pay rises nor long holidays, just stability.
So that was it. Ahmed tried to remember whether he'd talked about getting rid of the nanny to anyone, talk she could have overheard. He'd mentioned it to Simi several times. It was possible. But was it also possible that was all Mary Cox really wanted, to buy her silence? Ahmed Erdin looked at her and forced himself to smile. She was strangled. Emma Mungun put the doctor's report back on his desk. Yes, Artur Sarkisian said. I don't remember any marks in her neck. There aren't always any. and she had been submerged in water for some hours, which had discoloured and deformed the tissues. So it was strangulation that killed her.
Yes and no, the doctor said. She was strangled from behind, and I would say with hands or in the crook of an arm, crushing the larynx as pressure was exerted. Whoever killed Aishal Ujjal wanted it to look like suicide. He didn't realize that once dead, bloodletting isn't possible. As I said to Inspector Suleiman when I first saw her, I think that she was still just alive when she entered the water. But then she very quickly drowned, leading to the minimal loss of blood I recorded at the crime scene.
She was strangled and drowned.
Yes, a total botch, in my opinion, the doctor said. If the intention was to make Mrs. Ujjal's death look like suicide, whoever did it knew very little about the subtleties and mechanics of death.
Have you managed to contact any family members?
A brother, but he lives in Germany, Umar said. When the family were pushed out of Silikule, they scattered, like a lot of them. The brother told me that Aishal was always a bit on the wild side. Parents are dead. The brother, Ali, has got no idea where their other siblings are. He was quite interested when I told him his sister owned her own apartment.
Does he know how she got it?
He says not.
Artur Sarkisian nodded his head. Who would have thought taking one's clothes off could be so lucrative?
Omar smiled.
But then we know there is a man behind this, don't we?
Yes, Omar said. He didn't use Ahmed Erdin's name. Suleiman had told him they had to be careful who they shared that information with, even within the department and its supporting organizations.
Forensic have retrieved various samples from the apartment that may belong to people other than Mrs. Ujjal, the doctor said. From my point of view, I can tell you that Mrs. Ujjal's stomach was not full when she died, but she had recently snacked on sour plums, ayran, and a very small amount of cognac. She was a smoker, and she wasn't a virgin, although she hadn't had sex any time close to her death.
Her assailant didn't sexually abuse her?
No. In my opinion, she was first strangled from behind, then her wrists were slit, then she was drowned in the bath. Forensic tell me there was no sign of forced entry into the apartment, so she may well have known her attacker. Did the neighbors see or hear anything?
They say not, Umar said. And what with the garbager being over at Gezi Park? He sighed. He's still missing.
Which has to put him on whatever list of suspects you have, Otto said.
Garbagers always had keys to all the apartments under their care, so Jafar Ayan, the garbager of the dead woman's block, could have let himself into her apartment at any time. There was no reason to suppose he had killed her. Ayan was, according to the neighbors, an almost silent man who clearly hated his job and took very little notice of the residents. But Omar knew that appearances could be deceptive. When he left the doctor's office, he walked up to Gezi Park and looked at the tens of thousands gathered in the sunshine.
Look!
Yanis handed Harker the document that Ahmed Erdin had flung onto his front path, and then he sat down. Looking at it had exhausted him. He wasn't sleeping any more, and so it didn't take much. Harker registered the vast figure at the bottom of the document.
That's a huge amount of money.
A 30% increase, Yanis shrugged. Meaningless. It could be a million times that. I still wouldn't sell.
Told you before. Ignore it, Harker said. He gave it back.
How can I?
He's getting desperate. At the moment, you have the whip hand.
Oh, and if Erdin uses his influence to go for compulsory purchase? This area is littered with the rubble of buildings that have been bought and knocked down.
This isn't a slum, and it's an historic building, Harker said.
The others weren't slums either.
Harker let him fulminate impotently. He was good at that.
Then he said, if the Gezi people win, then people like Erdin will become a thing of the past.
Oh, and how realistic.
I know it's not likely. But even if they don't win, Erdin is desperate, and in his desperation he will make a mistake. He may have already made one, Harker said. You said yourself that a woman who may be his mistress has been found dead in Moda.
I don't know for certain it's her.
Maybe, maybe not, Akka said. But whatever is happening, you need to calm down. You've got no self-control. A man your age should be able to master his emotions. I know he's out there now, and it is unpleasant, but, as Chetin Bey said, it's only a game. There is nothing he can do at this point.
I should show him around the house, Yanis said. Everywhere.
Why?
Because I know, and you know, I'll be able to control it,
Yanis said. When you can't even control yourself, don't be ridiculous.
Yes, it's what I do,
Yanis said.
Prove to him that what he thinks is here isn't.
That is why he wants this house. He wants to please his god by destroying the trappings of a past he envies.
That's what fanatics do.
Yes, and you are being just as much of a fanatic as Odin, Akka said.
No, I'm not.
Yes, you are. You want to prove that you can master him, outwit him, and prove him wrong. Who do you think you are, eh? And what if you fail?
You may.
Akka held up a warning finger. You are not invincible, and you don't need to do this. Do nothing. Odin is sweating. Leave him in his filth. Let him sit out there day after day, adding yet more knots to that figure, and forget about him. I know it's hard, but Madame gets distressed every time there is a commotion or a bad atmosphere in the house. We must think of her health. You know I don't give a damn about you, but we both care about her. She is all that matters.
I know.
They sat in silence for a while. It was very pleasant and shady in the plant-filled garden, and under normal circumstances they would both have enjoyed just drinking lemonade and smoking. But Yanis could see Ahmet Erden's car from where he was sitting, and it stuck in his brain like a splinter. Eventually, unable to contain himself any longer, he said,
"No, I'll end this."
"What?"
"I'll invite him in tomorrow. That should give me enough time to prepare."
And then, seeing that Harker was about to speak again, he held up a hand.
"I don't want to know what you think. My mind is made up. The only way that Odin and anyone else who may have theories about this house is going to go away is if I prove them wrong. And I know I can do it. And so do you."
Gezi was creating such odd bedfellows. Beri Mungun hadn't had an easy time getting into the park that afternoon. The police were getting rough again, and were preventing people from entering by force, even those in Nessa's uniforms. But luckily for Peri, a very tall, slim transsexual had come to her aid. When an officer had pushed Peri, she'd raced out of the park and said,
"Hey, you! Leave that woman alone! She's a nurse!"
He'd said something not too complimentary under his breath.
"Don't swear at me, boy,"
the transsexual had said. And then she'd pulled Peri towards her, and they'd run together back to the park. Peri had thanked her rescuer, who she discovered was called Pimbe, and had joined her and her friends, who were making tea on a small camping stove. They were an odd little group. There was one other transsexual, called Madame Edith, who apparently had a cabaret act based on the songs of the legendary Edith Piaf. Then there were two young girls and a baby. Completely covered, the girls were part of the Muslims Against Capitalism group.
"Now, who would like tea?"
Madame Edith asked. Pimber declined in favour of another cigarette, while the girl said yes, and Peri was very glad of a glass. She'd had to pander to the whims of a woman who'd had an elective caesarean section for most of the day, and she was tired. As soon as the woman's baby had arrived, she'd lost interest in it. Unlike these two girls. She asked them what the baby's name was, and there was a slight and rather awkward pause before one of them said,
"Ali."
"Is he your little brother?" Peri asked. This time they both spoke at once.
"Yes, we're looking after him for a friend."
Peri looked at Pimbe and Madame Edith, neither of whom seemed perturbed by what the girls had said. Madame Edith, still on the tea, said,
"So does the baby want some tea? I don't know about these things. Do babies drink tea?"
No,
one of the girls said. She took a bottle out of a bag.
I've got milk.
Okay.
She fed the baby, whose clothes were, unlike the girl's clothes, dirty. There were new and used nappies in the bag the girls had brought with them, but they didn't once put a new vest on him, even when he dribbled milk down his front. Once Madame Edith had finished her tea, she lay down for a nap in the sunshine. Pimble looked at her and shook her head.
Napping like a grandma. I'm going to find some food.
She left. Madame Edith snored, and Perry looked at the baby. Not newborn, although not far off. He was a fractious little thing, who nevertheless drank his milk. But his limbs were thin. Perry put her fingers around the top of one of his arms, and she could feel his bones.
"This is a friend's baby,"
she said. Both girls' eyes were big, but they both said,
"Yes."
"Where is she, your friend?"
"Working,"
the girl on the left said. Her companion nodded.
"Oh?
What does she do?"
"She... Why do you want to know?"
the girl on the right said.
"What's it to you?"
Perry knew she'd have to proceed carefully. She wasn't convinced of their story. How could she be when they hadn't initially agreed on the child's identity? She said, "I'm a nurse, and so I can't help noticing when things aren't right, especially with children. Little Ali is very thin."
"His mother's poor," the girl on the right said. "That's why she works."
"I accept that," Perry said, "and I'm sure she's doing the best that she can for him.
Her husband ran away."
"That's really unfortunate," Perry said. "But the little one's clothes are very dirty. I'm sure she could wash them from time to time. I see she's given you lots of nappies, and so she must have some money." Neither of the girls said anything, but their eyes wouldn't meet hers. With Madame Edith asleep and Pembe off who knew where, Perry knew she only had a limited amount of time on her own with the girls. At any moment they could disappear off into the gazy crowds and be lost forever, and, although she didn't know that they'd done anything wrong, she knew she couldn't live with herself if they had, and she'd done nothing. She glanced around to see if anyone was watching. "Look," she said, "you're bright girls. You've got your own opinions on what is going on in the world, and you keep yourselves informed. You must know about this baby that's missing."
"This baby is a friend's," the girl on the right said. "She has to work."
"What does she do?" They looked at each other again. Was Perry mistaken, or did the one on the left look as if she might be about to cry?
"She is a prostitute," the one on the right said. "A bad thing to be, but we don't judge. The real Muslim way is to care and to understand."
Perry was sure that she was sincere, and in her experience, sincere religious people of all kinds didn't judge. They were nice girls.
"That's a very fine sentiment," Perry said.
The girl on the right began to stand up.
"Where are you going?" "I think we have to go now,"
she said, as she helped her friend, with the baby in her arms, to her feet. Perry quickly stood too. Then she put a hand on the baby's leg.
"Listen," she said,
"a baby went missing last week. I know you'll know this. It was all over the news. It happened in Sultan Ahmed. The baby's mother died."
"I heard about it, yes."
"Well, my brother, who is a police officer..." Both girls visibly cringed. "Yes, I know what they've been doing here, gassing people, beating them, but my brother is a detective," Perry said. "He's a good man, and my brother has a colleague, another nice man like him, who spends all his time at the moment looking for a baby he fears might be suffering or even dead. Now, if you really do have a friend who is a prostitute, who is this baby's mother, I'd like you to take me to her, because I think she might need some help looking after the child. I can give her that help. But if there is no friend, and you, for every good reason, are looking after this baby because you found him, then you need to talk to my brother's colleague. He won't hurt you, and you won't get into trouble, because I'm sure you've been looking after this baby because you care for him."
"We heard the mother was dead. We feared for him,"
the girl on the left blurted.
"Fatima!"
The girl on the left freed a hand and grabbed her friend's arm.
"Milda, we can't go on bringing him here every day. What if he gets gassed?"
Perry's instinct was to grab the baby, but she resisted. At least one of the girls was coming to the conclusion that things could not stay as they were. But the girl on the right began to move away. Come on, Fatima, she said. We've got to get the boy back to his mother.
But Peri kept her hand on the boy's leg and looked into Fatima's eyes. The girl was close to tears.
You don't even know this child's name, do you? Peri said.
Chapter 18. Chetin Eekman only saw the baby for a moment before he was taken into the care of social services. The only impression he got of him was that he was very small, very loud, and he was white. Together with Kerim Gürsel, he interviewed the two girls, Fatima and Milda Erol, in his office. He knew that they were terrified, and that exposure to one of the windowless interview rooms would make them clam up immediately. He'd given the option of having their father or a brother with them, but Fatima said that they didn't want their family to know about the baby. Milda added that they didn't need men.
"Where did you find the baby?"
Eekman asked.
"In an outhouse," Milda said.
"Where?"
"On the street where we live."
"Which is?"
"Kuchuk Yusufak Jadisi, opposite the mosque."
"So where in relation to your home is this outhouse?"
"Towards Nakil Bent Mosque on the right."
2 minutes from the Svendong. Chetin Eekman began to sweat. Had he, or rather Sergeant Mungun's sister, just found Ariadne Sava's lost baby?
"It's just a shack," Fatima said. "Street kids play in there sometimes, but also dogs, some of them fierce. We can take you there."
Eekman turned to Kerim Gürsel.
"Get Kucuk Ayasofa cordoned off,
sir."
Gürsel left the room.
"When did you find the child?" Eekman asked.
"The day after Gizi really started. Last week," Fatima said.
"The 29th of May?"
"Yes."
"How did you find the child?"
Milda spoke. "It was early, 6 a.m. Fatima and I were taking soup to our grandmother for her breakfast. She lives on Nakil Ben Sukak. She's got arthritis," Milda said. "Our mother makes her meals every day and does all her laundry. We're always backwards and forwards."
Eekman said, "The baby?"
"Oh, yes, we heard him crying," Milda said. "A very weak cry. We were very cautious when we went into the old outhouse because we thought there might be dogs in there," Fatima said. "But there was just a baby, naked and covered in blood," Milda said. "Just lying on the ground."
"On anything?"
"No."
Kerim returned and nodded at Eekman. They would have to obtain a basic outline from these girls, and then get them over to Kucuk Ayasofa as soon as possible.
"I wrapped him in one of the towels Mother had laundered for Grandma," Milda said. "Then we took him with us."
"To your grandmother's?"
"Yes."
"What did your grandmother have to say about that?" Eekman asked.
"He made her smile,"
Fatima said. "Did you tell your grandmother where you'd found him?"
"Yes." "She said that he was probably a prostitute's baby," Milda said. "She said they often leave them for people to find and give a decent life."
This was true, although, as Eekman knew, they usually ended up in state orphanages.
"Grandma said we should keep him," Fatima said. "At her apartment," Milda said. "She told us what milk to buy and where to get some clothes for him."
"What about your parents?" Kerim asked. "Did they know about the baby?"
"Oh, no," Fatima said. "Mother has a good heart, but she is one of those Muslims who judges. She wouldn't have had a prostitute's baby in the house."
"What were you and your grandmother going to do with the baby in the long term?" Eekman asked.
The two girls looked at each other, and then Milda said,
"When we found out that a baby was missing and that its mother had been killed, we became even more fearful for him. Grandma said that we had to be careful where we bought milk and clothes and not to get them locally any more. We started taking him to Gezi to give Grandma a rest. And because we believe in Gezi," Fatima said.
"And so you didn't think that it might be better to let us know you had what could be a dead woman's baby and allow us to call off our search?" Eekman asked. He wasn't exactly angry with the Erol girls, but he was resentful of their fearful unworldliness. Fatima looked down at the floor, but Milda said,
"How could we trust you? Look at Gezi. How can we trust the police?"
"And yet here you are."
"If Nurse Peri hadn't persuaded us, we wouldn't be,"
Melda said. Her sister put a hand on her shoulder.
But we weren't coping, were we, Melda?
There was a pause. Melda, too, looked down now. Then she said,
His clothes were dirty. We couldn't take them home to wash. And he was thin.
She began to cry. Hickman, though irritated by them, also felt some sympathy for the Errol girls. They'd done what they'd thought was right in the face of what he imagined to be a very strict and judgmental mother. You saved the baby's life, he said. That's the main thing. Yanis's hand shook as he knocked on the car window. Ahmed Erdin, who hadn't seen him leave his house, rolled the window down.
I don't know what you think is in my house, Erdin, Yanis said,
but I'm sure that you do. Erdin smiled, and Yanis had to look away.
You can come inside and look for yourself tomorrow morning,
Yanis said. There was a pause. Ahmed Erdin hadn't been expecting that. However, he retained his composure. Why tomorrow? Why not now? Yanis wanted to say, it's none of your business, but he didn't have the confidence.
My mother is sleeping, he said. It isn't convenient.
He was cool. When he looked Yanis in the eye, the effect was unnerving. Had he done the right thing? Ahmed Erdin wasn't some kid he could enchant, some visitor with half-remembered impressions of the house in his mind. Erdin, if he was telling the truth, remembered it all. And in spite of what Haka always maintained, he'd seen something.
Get here before midday, and I'll let you in, Yanis said.
I'll think about it.
The coolness made him angry.
As the property developer pushed a button to raise his car window, Yanis yelled into the contracting space,
You'd better, because it's going to be the last chance you ever get.
Hürrem Tekke had hoped, in a way, that the erotic photographs of Ahmed Erdin and Ayşel Ocal had been photoshopped. Dealing with people like him was always a nightmare. But they hadn't been. In the opinion of the photographic expert who had looked at them, they were genuine. Erdin had had an affair with the woman she now knew was also called Gulizar. She knew why he'd lied about it. Erdin was famous for his piety, his devotion to his Down syndrome daughter, and his espousal of family values. Fucking a gypsy woman didn't fit in with that. Briefly, she thought about her own officer, Suleiman, enthralled to a gypsy. Then she looked at the photographic report again. There was no getting around it. Erdin had been with the woman. He may even have bought the apartment for her. It was in her name, but where would a stripper in low-rent clubs have got enough money to buy an apartment in Moda for cash? The neighbors said that a man did visit, but none of them knew who he was. Those who had seen him said he always wore an overcoat and a fedora hat, whatever the weather, and he always turned his face away from anyone he met on the stairs. Clearly, he didn't want to be recognized. But that would fit with Erdin very well. But what the neighbors had also said was that the carpenter had been seen talking to the man. The carpenter who, again according to the neighbors, was somewhere here in Gezi Park. What was certain now was that Ahmed Erdin had lied. He'd been having an affair with Ayşel Ocal at some point, and he denied it. And in the absence of final results from forensic tests on the body and the apartment, he was the only subject in the frame. But he was in his daughter's bedroom all night, Suleiman said when Tekke called him to give him the photographic expert's opinion. The nanny said he didn't leave. She was awake all night.
Maybe the nanny lied, Tekke said. Maybe she's in love with Erdin and wants to protect him.
She heard Suleiman sigh. One thing I have been told is that the connection between Erdin and Inspector Ickman's hippodrome victim was more visceral and more pertinent than we thought. How so? According to one of the Gizli Tepe rubbish pickers Çetin Bey interviewed, Dr. Sava knew that Erdin had a mistress. She didn't tell this Nurettin who she was or where she lived, but it's possible she tried to use that knowledge to blackmail Erdin. For money? Çetin Bey thinks it's more likely she was trying to force Erdin to rehouse the rubbish pickers. How noble. She hadn't meant it to sound sarcastic, but that was how Suleiman took it. I think so, he said.
Yes, and so do I, Dekker said. I wasn't being... Look, Suleiman, what we need to do before we go back to Erden is to re-interview the nanny, get her in here to make a formal statement, and impress upon her the full, shall we say, force of Turkish law.